free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net, where you can see our past lineup of speakers, downloads, and past shows, and see who's coming down the pike. And if you're listening live, you can get some phone numbers there where you can call in with some questions. We do ask that you postpone your calls to the end of the show to see if we can address those questions in the course of our interviewing. Our guests today, September 22nd, 2008, are two gentlemen, Alfred and Gunther Weisbrick. Alfred is the founder and inventor, and Gunther is his business partner of what's called the Warp Tower and Module. Warp stands for Wind Amplified Rotor Platform, which speeds up the wind with a velocity amplification factor in excess of 1.5 fold over free wind. And what, since wind has a, the power from wind is a cubed function of the wind speed, by increasing the wind speed 1.5, you actually get a 4.5 fold increase in the power derived from the tower as a result. The projected cost for the installation will be between, for the energy cost would be 2 cents to 4 cents per kilowatt hour, which puts it in competition with coal and natural gas power plants. Alfred and Gunther, thanks for joining us. We appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thank you very much for having us, Sterling.
Yeah, I've given a little bit of an introduction here, but why don't you go ahead and give us kind of an overview of the technology, how it works, and kind of what it looks like. I would just describe it as an hourglass shape, a repeating hourglass with the turbine situated in the small crevice between the smallest segment of the hourglass.
You're right, Sterling, that is probably not a bad way to describe it. And as you had pointed out already, the warp increases the wind speed by about 1.5, and it's been calculated up to about 1.8 times as well, depending on the configuration of the warp. Warp being comprised of a stack of hourglass-like shaped modules, it needs to be stressed, though, that unlike an hourglass, which has a very narrow neck, the warps have a much broader neck, so that you have a much larger module base, if you will, for these hourglass shapes.
One of these towers resembles a post and a stair rail.
A post and a stair rail. That's an interesting yes.
It might be useful for people to know that they can go onto our website, because you know a picture is worth a thousand words. So if they're listening, they may want to check out our website at www.warp-enecode.com. That's warp-enecode.com, and then just go on to our slideshow presentation, and again, a picture's worth a thousand words.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, the real emphasis here is, as you had pointed out, is the amplification of the wind, and what does that do for us? It allows us to use much smaller rotors than would conventionally be used to get the same power. However, I want to make one thing perfectly clear, which sometimes gets lost in the translation. We're not claiming to be able to generate four times more power, or as it were, for a given cross-sectional area, or capture area, as it's known in the industry. The capture area is the profile of the working part of the system. For a large-bladed wind turbine, that would be the disk swept out by the blades. The area of that that disc, that's the capture area. And for a warp, it would be the profile, if you will, a silhouette of the warp system. Now, given those two areas, if they're identical, then just broadly speaking, they would be able to generate about the same amount of power and energy. The warp would be able to get somewhat more because it has fewer losses. For example, it doesn't require the gearboxes, so you don't have gearbox losses, or it doesn't have as many of the free air tip regime, like a free air rotor, so it has fewer tip losses. That's why in the aircraft industry, for example, you have ducted fans for propulsion as opposed to open air propellers. The ducts give you the opportunity to cut down dramatically on your tip losses as opposed to an open air propeller. Same thing in wind turbines here.
Yeah, and you could actually use a number of turbine designs, whatever's the most efficient at the time. It doesn't have to be the propeller type design. It could be a vertical axis, or it could be some other newfangled turbine design in the position of the turbine when you install one of these things.
Absolutely, absolutely. The warp is blind, really, to some degree, and independent of the actual rotor capture mechanism. And someone comes up with a newfangled device to capture wind, it's possible to tailor the warp channel, as it were, for that particular type of capture mechanism. And you're absolutely right. It's even conceivable to put in vertical axis rotors, although vertical axis machines are known to be less efficient than the propeller types, which are sort of the classic standard in terms of rotor used for wind turbines.
I know some vertical axis people who disagree with you on that. We have a number of designs that are claiming to be superior. But whatever the case...
Well, if they are superior, they can still be put into our system and even be more superior.
Right. One of the advantages of your system, let's talk about the modularity, where rather than having this huge... I was talking to my associate, James Arthur Jancic, who does my Sunday night show with me, talking about, you know, recapping the news of the week, this week in free energy. He was recently driving through one of these wind farm areas because of the detour on the normal traffic, and he was astonished at how huge those things are, those turbines. And the blades and the engineering that has to go into those, if one of those goes out, and we showed a video a couple weeks ago of the failure of one of these huge turbine blades as it got spinning too fast and the thing fell to destruction and it went flying all over the place, and it was really, really quite amazing to see. And you wouldn't want to be anywhere around that thing when it fell apart.
Absolutely. That can be an extraordinarily traumatic event. In fact, I was involved in the development of the 4-megawatt machine for the Department of the Interior with NASA under Hamilton Standard, that's United Technologies Corporation. And that machine eventually had a problem with the generator. Someone dropped something into the generator system, and it was all fouled up. So it lay idle for a considerable amount of time until it changed something. Somebody changed the windings on the generator. However, having said that, when it started up again, there was an issue of the rotor starting up again, and one of the blades didn't track properly and hit the tower, and it came flying off. And talking about a spectacular failure, the person that was actually doing the work on the machine was down in the tower inside. Fortunately, at the tower, the machine had a shutoff when it went into high vibration. Otherwise, it would have self-destructed in the same way as this other machine, probably. So this is one of the dangers, obviously, and risks of large-bladed type systems.
And your system gets away from that because the blades are much smaller, and you have the modularity. If one of them does go out, it doesn't take out the entire system. You just have one unit that's not operating, and you can go in and replace that one while the rest are turning away.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we're dealing with rotors here that have a history, over 100-year history now. We're talking about propeller-sized rotors that are on the order of maybe 10, maybe 20 feet in diameter maximum, which is, compared to today's wind turbine rotors, is a very small fraction of the size. And we know that these kind of rotors can be built to withstand hundreds of miles an hour, just as they are on aircraft propellers where they fly at 200-300 miles an hour with them.
Yeah. And so in your design, you're taking basically an airline prop and using that as your to turn the turbine or to turn the generator?
Right. And we're not suggesting that's an airline propeller. It's the scale of airline propellers is what I'm saying. There's, you know, the structure and the structural integrity can be readily, you know, designed into that kind of a propeller of that scale, whereas hundreds of feet in diameter that's still fairly new stuff and has to run 20, 30 years. So a lot of things can happen in 20, 30 years, and a lot of fatigue takes place in 20, 30 years. So it's a little bit different. It's dealing with a known entity as opposed to an unknown, a little less known entity in that respect.
Also, with the modularity, you get to economies of scale where for one tower, let's say you've got 100 props as opposed to just three for one of these huge turbine blades, each one of which, you know, has to be have super high tolerances and have the rigidity and whatnot to be able to withstand the forces that it's going through. You can make a bunch of these smaller ones in a much more cost-effective manner, and not to mention the ease of installation, where you don't have to have these big, massive, long truck assemblies hauling these things down the freeway trying to get them up the side of a hill or a slope. You can install them in a lot more places and get them there a lot easier.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can put these units on pickup trucks, basically. The system breaks down into very small modular components. Even the module itself, which is this sort of donut-shaped structure, really is broken down into individualized panels that are all identical. One panel shape, in essence, or two panel shapes can make up the entire system, exterior skin system. There's no unique different types of structures that are needed to make that external amplifier shape. So that really lends itself to mass production. And like we all know, mass production leads to lower costs. Because if we all remember, some of us may not, but when calculators first came out, electronic calculators, the first ones cost like hundreds of dollars. And today, because of mass production of these things, you can get them for less than $10-$20.
Yeah, depends on what kind of calculator you're talking about. Now they sit on your wristwatch for a buck.
That's right. So, yes, in essence, the warp system can be somewhat of an analogy also when talking about computers and systems. It's really a paradigm shift in translating to small modular systems. Like in the computer industry, they shifted from mainframe computers to PCs. Well, this is a little bit like the mainframe is the big bladed system, and the PC would be the modular warp system.
Another advantage I'd like to mention and bring up early on here, in my opinion, this just may be a matter of taste, but I think that your tower is much more aesthetically pleasing than a prop system. It looks more like a building. It looks more like a building-type structure. It has some angles that are appealing rather than the other way around.
Well, thank you very much. I think Gunther will agree. We would certainly love to hear more of that kind of feedback from what the public would think about this. We've certainly gotten feedback from architects and people in general, and that seems to be a general consensus. Naturally, for us to say, yeah, it's we like the way it looks, that's sort of like saying you like your own baby. You know,
right.
No mother's going to say they don't like their own baby. But it's good to hear that from a third party and an objective view, so to speak.
You know, I would see it be easy to implement these on the top of a building, for example, and it wouldn't look like a wind turbine. It would look like an extension of the structure of the building.
Absolutely. If you look down the New York City skyline ever, and all you see are these buildings with these, some of them have just ugly water towers on top, but most of them have these pillboxes sitting on top. It is not inconceivable that you could actually dress up buildings using this technology. And on new buildings particularly would be highly economic because the top of the building would really have multi-use. The tarp, rather the module, which is sometimes referred to as a tarp, but the warp module really has housing value on the inside. So it can encase things like the mechanical rooms or elevator HVAC, a variety of things. It could,
or even nowadays, kind of where everybody's putting in telecommunication towers on top of their buildings, you know, that can all be housed on the inside of the warp system.
While peripherally, it's providing energy. So
a dual-purpose type of structure.
The economics look particularly attractive on a building whereby it's designed as part of a new building. Because the system thereby has this multi-use capability, and it, by rights it's possible to utilize it for both parts of the system, for the energy as well as for the building's base function.
One thing we've not talked about from a mechanical point of view is with the wind turbine, you want it to be pointed into the wind. Let's talk for a minute about how you point these. We haven't talked about the actual where the turbines sit on this. You've got one on each side of each one of these hourglass segments. How are we orienting that into the wind?
The rotors are actually self-aligning to the wind. The intent is to have them be passive, so that the module passively orients itself into the wind. The rotors want thrust equilibrium or drag equilibrium, whichever way you want to look at it. So the tendency is for those rotors to align directly squarely to the wind, which is actually somewhat of a better arrangement than what you have with conventional wind turbines, which even if they were to be free yaw, they would always misalign a little bit because of precessional forces. That's just a natural gyroscopic effect that you get with a wind turbine. But in conventional wind turbines, as you probably know, most wind turbines are driven, yaw-driven to face the wind. Well, as we all know, wind moves around quite a bit. So it's always hunting for the wind and to align. And if it gets off a certain amount, then it starts to crank around and follow the wind. Well, in a warp, because you've got two rotors, twin rotors, they automatically always want to be square to the wind. And then there's the other question, which you probably will be asking, well, what about if you've got very high winds and you want to get out of the wind? Well, all it requires is a slight drag difference between the two rotors, which can be a braking action, or it can be done electrically, aerodynamically, or mechanically, and it vectors the rotors out of the wind and puts them into the relatively protected regions of the stagnation point, which is ahead, and the wake region, which is downstream. So it's about as protected as you can protect a wind turbine as compared to a conventional turbine, which is always going to be exposed to the wind. And, in fact, that's probably one of the big design drivers structurally for a wind turbine is the survival wind speed when it's just sitting there parked.
So the picture that we have on our site of one of these segments that's repeated up the tower resembles a flying saucer with the two turbines, the paired turbines on the left and the right of the flying saucer, which is then inserted into the tower and repeated going up the tower. And you're saying that each one of these saucer segments is rotating freely around the tower and can orient as needed to the wind. But then in the case of a wind storm where you want to protect the turbines from a high wind, you would actually mechanically orient that so that it is not actually turned sideways, so it's turning the turbines.
Right, exactly.
Now, if I may kind of describe that a little bit in layman's terms, what would happen is that if you put a brake on one of the rotors, then there's a disequilibrium there, And it basically weather vanes out of the wind. And that's what Al was trying to say. Because they're normally stable if they're perpendicular to the wind direction. And if you put a brake on one of them, then all of a sudden it'll weather vane to the back of the module in the wake area. So it's no longer in the wind as it normally would be.
I see. Okay, so one of them stops spinning, the other one is still spinning, and it's so that push unbalance between them causes the saucer shape to turn, so it's not in a favorable configuration to optimal wind capturing, which is the way you want it in
exactly.
A severe wind situation.
Exactly, and in the same principle holds true then also in case you have some kind of a problem with a rotor system. Let's say one rotor has a bearing starting to fail, and it begins to get rougher and rougher and seize, or possibly seize, not even have to seize, just it starts to drag more. Well, that's like a braking action on one rotor, and that sense is sensed, and right away that rotor module will move itself out of the wind because it no longer has this equilibrium, drag equilibrium from one side to the other. So it's a fail-safe system in that respect, and to prevent it from beating itself to death in a storm or a wind by doing that.
Okay. So it basically is also a, in the case of the failure of a turbine, helps protect the turbine from going to destruction and causing damage to the apparatus.
That's correct.
Now let's talk about the rigidity and the structural integrity that's going to be required of such a tower, where you've got a lot of wind force pushing on the tower, and I guess they've got the same problem with one of these large propeller type systems. In terms of the footing and how you structurally build this thing in the tower, do you have special considerations in that regard as to being able to anchor this thing appropriately?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's not unlike, you had mentioned earlier, like a building. Now, a lot of buildings, as you know, are flat plate. They're rectangular, even if it's a square cross-section building. It's mostly flat plate. Flat plate has the highest drag possible. Now, if you have a tower like a warp, which has this aerodynamic, effectively circular cross-section, the drag is substantially lower on that kind of a structure. And you can also, in this case, not only build it into a foundation like you would a building, so that you, or for that matter, a regular wind turbine has a big, big, deep foundation. Here you have your whole wind load, distributed across the profile of the tower. On a conventional wind turbine, your load is all concentrated at the very pinnacle of the tower. So it's like a giant fatigue machine. There's a big difference here in how the load is distributed. So it, from a structural standpoint, it's much more easily implemented than it is a conventional wind turbine. Plus, you have the option of guying if you should want to do that. Let's say you have a very tall, very slender warp arrangement, just like maybe a high-definition TV tower structure. Those go up to 1,500 feet, for example. Then you may want to guy it, which is possible. You can guy to virtually any point on the tower and not interfere because, as we probably failed to mention, these modules are really replicated in alternate static and yawable. So you really have a static one adjacent to every yawable module, because if you look at the modules again, there are really a rotor above it and a rotor set below it in the arrangement of the so-called best-selling saucer.
Mm-hmm.
But and adjacent to that would be an identical module, except it would be have no rotors, and it would be rigidly affixed to the tower to complete, in essence, that channeling effect. And that actually has an enhancement of structural integrity for the tower, the core tower, having that static module assisting the bracing of that tower.
And, of course, with the three-bladed turbine, you can't put guy wires on the top because that would impede the rotation of the blades. Whereas in your system, where you have a fixed non-rotating portion at the top, putting guy wires to stabilize the top of the tower would be no problem.
Exactly. It gets a little nasty when you try to have the big rotor blades cut through some guy wires.
And it also needs to be pointed out that with the large bladed turbines, all the stresses are at a focal point. It's at one point where the blade is connected to the nacelle. And that's a lot of stress for that foundation. With the warp, everything seems to be very evenly distributed. So there is not any focal point like a large bladed turbine has to deal with.
I would think that the vibration issues are going to be many times less because you have a lot of small turbines rather than one large one, so things kind of balance out more. There may be some resonance that may pick up at times. It might get some noise going or some vibrations going, but most of the time I would think that things would kind of cancel each other out and it would be fairly benign noise and vibration-wise.
You're bringing up a very, very good, and it's actually a fairly sophisticated point in the design of structures like that. One of the big major challenges in large-bladed wind turbines is avoiding the resonance of the blades to the tower, because both the tower and the blades are comparable structures, so they have a natural frequency that's fairly close. In a warp situation, the tower natural frequency is so far removed from the rotor natural frequency that the interaction is virtually non-existent. So
You're absolutely right.
That mitigates that kind of issue, structural issue, right off the bat. That's a very good question, a very good point.
So because you basically have a similar wavelength, so to speak, in the length of the blade and the height of the tower, it's easy to get in a resonant situation there, whereas with the length of the blade in your system is going to be many times smaller than the height of the tower or even the diameter of each one of the spheres. Each one of, not the sphere, the saucers, you don't get the resonance with the saucer unless you have a multiplication where you've got, let's say the saucer is exactly four times the diameter of the blade, then you might get some resonance that way.
Right. The structure of the saucer is radically different from that of the blade. The frequency of the rotors is extraordinarily high, whereas the frequency of the natural frequency of the structure is extraordinarily low. So the two interacting is fairly remote at best.
So as before, putting a wind turbine on top of a building was counterindicated because of the vibrations and the noise that it would resonate down through the building. Whereas one of these things, you wouldn't have that problem?
No, you wouldn't. In fact, it would be actually less of a problem than you would have right now when you have HVAC fans. If you've ever looked at the top of a tall building in New York or whatever, you see all these HVAC fans, rotors, operating, and they're probably actually more powerful than a warp wind turbine of the same diameter. Only there you have to put power in the other one you get power out.
Right. So from a architectural point of view, and an aesthetic point of view, and an acoustical point of view, putting a warp tower on top of a building is basically no drama?
Should be no drama. It's like anything else. It's just good engineering execution.
So basically it's adding some additional wind drag, but not as much as if it was a flat face extension of the building up that far.
Absolutely. Right. Yes.
Now, one of the things that I've broached with, I think, Gunther before, that he seems to shy away from, and I don't quite understand why, is when I look at the shape of this thing, and I understand from the wind sector that even though wind tends to blow in all different directions, in any given location there is a predominant direction that the wind blows. And I would picture that you could wrap the edges of a building with this design all the way up, so that you have a fixed, rather than a yawing saucer, you have a fixed saucer going up. And it's not a full circle, it's just
a semicircle on the edge of the building.
Yeah, a three-quarter turn to thrust out the edge of the building, then you have one of these blades in between each one of the saucers going up. As you mentioned, it's not actually on every one of them on the rotating one, but it's top and bottom of one, and then you have a fixed one and you have a yawing one. But on the building, it can all be fixed, pointing in the predominant direction of the wind, actually harnessing the wind that is forced off the edge of the building going around the building. Why wouldn't that be something you'd want to design into a building?
Well, there are probably a couple of reasons. One of which is sensitivity of the flow about that, let's say, three-quarter turn is fairly high. The rotor wants to track exactly where that is. If you're off and it doesn't track right to the wind, and now you don't have a way of tracking because you've got a one-sided, it's like a one-armed bandit out there.
Mm-hmm.
Now you need some kind of a mechanism to try to put it into alignment with the wind exactly. So now you need power in to get power out. You're back at the game that the regular wind turbines have where they have to put power into yaw and face it into the wind. It just can't make it as effective in terms of power recovery, because those would have to be fairly small now. And that's not to say, you've got a little column going up. Anything can be done, but it gets to be now much more complex than you would ordinarily. Whereas if you were to take that and make one or two pile of modules just near the top, which, by the way, the higher you go, the better your energy resources in the first place, you would be able to probably get 3 to 4 times the amount of energy and power out than by the time you've put something along the edge of a building.
So
and you have to deal with other, flow from other buildings. Not every building is standalone out there in the, not influenced by turbulence and so on from other structures around.
One thing we've not talked about in terms of background, Alfred, if I understand right, you have a background professionally in the aeronautics engineering arena, and that was what drove this design.
That's correct.
And so in a wind tunnel, for example, if I understand what you're saying, it's not that if you have wind coming straight onto a tower, the ideal position for the focusing of the wind's power is at the perpendicular position, not before, not after, that's where the best position is for that rotor to be situated. And so if you were to have a fixed unit on the edge of a building, because it's not going to be in the optimal position all the time, it wouldn't make sense to put it there?
That's correct. You would be very compromising the performance of that, and the control systems and so on that you would have to implement to keep it on track in conjunction with the building would be fairly high. Not to mention that the building itself would probably shed a lot of turbulence on this, much more so. You see, there's no pre-grooming that takes place as it does in a normal warp module. That's one of the benefits also. In free air, first of all, there's a lot of tumbling of the wind to begin with, and when it impacts a rotor does not like a lot of turbulence. In the warp sense, because you've got this bluff, smooth aerodynamic shaped body out in front, it pre-grooms your flow before it gets to the rotor, and the rotor can then accept it in a much better fashion. Again, with your proposed concept of having these edges, you would have a high boundary layer coming off the building that is influenced by windows, everything else that's along comes along the way, even edges and so on, particularly an edge and an edge out front. Obviously, you must have an edge out front if you have an edge to either side, then unless you make it perfectly round, which is conceivable. But then, again, you still run into the problem of having to face the rotors into the wind if the wind shifts a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Aerodynamics are very sensitive. Coming out of the aerospace industry and the aircraft industry, a little change in angle of attack has a lot of influence on the loads and things that you see in a structure.
Okay, so you've talked me out of thinking that that's a good idea.
Well, that's not to say go ahead and patent it. It might be even patentable.
But let's talk for a second about the mechanics of rotating the yaw, because you've got a fairly large surface between these saucers. Picture them almost like a bowl, two bowls with the bottoms toward each other, and you're rotating on that, you're pivoting on the bottom surface of the bowl. That's a lot of rubbing surface. How do you address the mechanical issues where you've got sand and grit blowing around? That seems like you're introducing a lot of moving parts to a system.
Well, first of all, the modules would be on a track that's, first of all, internalized. It's all protected on the inside. So you have a track and trolley system that would exist in this case. The driving force are the two rotors on either side. Now, they represent a great moment arm to responding. In fact, when we built our first small unit up in under the New York State IRTA program, we used trolley wheels that were on journal bearings. And those of the people that don't know what a journal bearing is, it's simply metal rubbing on metal. It was not bearing wheels. And, in fact, it worked fairly well in that because you have such a huge moment arm on those rotors, they can easily rotate the system. You, in fact, some people have suggested, well, why don't you put it onto, really a whole bearing surface, make this a giant bearing ring. No, that's not what you really want because you don't want it to react that bad. You want some damping in the system, especially when it comes to high winds. So it responds very well in just a track and trolley type of arrangement. This is what we've already discovered with our tests.
When you say track and trolley, I'm picturing a wheel on a track.
That's correct. A wheel on a track.
So,
and that track can be, designed many different ways. You can have a U-channel track. You can have just a regular track where it rides on it. But the basic principle would be just the rotation, letting it roll on that surface.
So
the friction coefficient is very low on those kind of situations.
You
think
really
of a car. If I may, just give you this analogy. Okay. If you have a car, and the reason this works particularly well with warp is because you have a rotor operating, which introduces some measure of dithering, if you will. If you have your car sitting in a parking lot, a flat surface parking lot, and you were to just put it in neutral and try to push it with your hand, okay, you might have a little hard time starting it up, aside from the fact that you're on rubber tires that are a little bit flat. But now you turn the engine on, and you have that engine vibration in conjunction with it, and you try to push that car now, it pushes relatively easily on the flat compared to when it was dead, unpowered.
Right.
Now, you have the same sort of principle in the warp where when those rotors are turning, they introduce a little bit of dithering, which makes for a very nice way of getting that module to start to respond in conjunction with obviously having a much bigger moment arm, which you didn't have in your car. You know, if you had had your car with a big gin pole on it and had some leverage, it would be that much easier to move it.
Okay. So just from a mechanical point of view, to kind of finish the story here, when you talk about a track and trolley, we're calling them, I don't know what you typically call each one of these units. I'm calling it a saucer.
That's okay, I like that.
What do you call them?
We call them a module.
Module?
Yeah, each saucer-like structure is a module.
So each module would need at least three wheels to keep it, so you have the, strength.
Mm-hmm.
How many wheels are you designing into each module?
That's a detailed design. You can have three, you can have four, you can have five. It depends on what's called for and what the particular client might want to do this. Again, we want to emphasize, we don't build units ourselves. Our model is to license the technology and joint venture with others to commercialize this.
Let's talk about that for a second, because you've had at least a couple of license situations out there. I know there's a website over in France and an installation in France where one of these things has been installed.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's one of the clients. So there's another one we are talking to right now. That's in South Africa, that's considering commercializing. And we've had numerous parties come to the table to want to commercialize. Many of them have had an issue with finding their financing. That was always the big problem, finding financing. But there's no lack of parties that recognize the potential of the technology. And clearly, it's a disruptive technology. It's like in the computer industry when PCs first came out, the mainframe computer folks didn't want to know about PCs because it's disruptive to their particular business. And you notice that there aren't too many of the big mainframes left anymore, like DEC, Burroughs, Data General. You don't hear much about that anymore, but you hear a lot of PCs now because IBM, fortunately, was the one that stepped up to it and decided to get into it. But the tendency is by the industry that's entrenched already not to go make their own system obsolete. And
yeah.
Although management gurus like Tom Peters suggest that to them, that when push comes to shove, they typically don't do that.
Back to the mechanics of the design. I'm trying to picture how you would maintain one of these. Let's say you've got one of the turbines has gone out. You need to replace it or you need to service it. You're going to have elevators on the inside or cranes that hoist you up to replace it on the outside. How are you getting to these things to service them?
The one key way is naturally through the inside where you have an elevator hoist that can reach each module. And you deal with it from that standpoint. Now, to get to the rotors, you may have an access panel that you exit through.
May want to mention that that's one of the issues with the static module. You know, just because it's static doesn't mean it doesn't have a lot of
function.
Good uses.
Yes, absolutely.
The static module is where you would work from, open a panel to work on the rotor above you, or open a panel below you to work on the rotors below you. I think it's important for people to kind of get an idea of scale here. And the warp is really all very scalable, and it's all based on the ratio from the rotor size that you would employ. So just as an example, if you had a 10-foot diameter rotor, And again, we kind of employ the term hip diameter and waist diameter because of the woman's shape, repetitive woman's shape. Well, if you had a 10-foot diameter rotor, your waist diameter would be 24 feet, the hip diameter would be 44 feet, and each modern
And may I interject, Gunther, just that's not a fixed number. That can be tailored to accommodate the various types of amplification you want, too. So there is a variation, a small variation that you can go to without it looking obtuse after a while.
Well, it was just an example to give an idea of what size we're talking about. But just even with a 10-foot rotor, you see that you would have a 24-foot diameter space. And that's plenty of space for an elevator to be put in.
Yeah. Probably multiple elevators, actually, for if you have a good enough size system. If you have a 3-4 megawatt system, you know, you would probably want to have at least maybe two elevators in there anyway. Who knows? Those are detailed design issues that obviously need to be addressed very closely then.
In a smaller system, you could just have a ladder going up there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you can also have a system that accesses things from the outside, not unlike you have in tall skyscraper buildings, the window washing scaffolding, except it would have probably skis or something like that, or a quasi-ski, whatever, so that you have a continuous standoff as you go from a module to module. Now, it all depends on what kind of a rotor arrangement you have. Traditionally, the rotor and generator are in line, but in warp, you can actually have the generator inside the module, so there's just a transfer from the rotor or the fan down to the generator on the inside. And that obviously makes life a lot simpler also for maintenance if you need to go access it in inclement weather or hostile environments. Some environments can be pretty daunting in wind turbine country.
We've also not addressed the issue of how you transmit the electricity generated from one turbine on this rotating yawing module into a central, how do you convey that electricity? You're going to have a positive and negative lead being carried. Are you going to have fingers on the edge of a metal piece? Are you going to be, I can be doing wireless transmission. How are you going to transmit that electricity being generated into the central gathering location?
Yeah, wireless is probably a little bit too advanced, although that's possible in the future sometime. But the typical way in this case would be by having simply a brush assembly that rotates against the periphery of the module, just like it would be for it's almost amusement park ride situation or track and trolley type of situation that you have on subways and so on. Just a rail that has the brush with it. So that's the one approach that's possible where you have allow continuous revolution, if you want to, of the module, so it never has a wind-up. You could also have umbilical, where it just is a hardwired across the rotating boundary, but it lets it only go, let's say, 270 degrees, after which, if it hits a stop, then it automatically rewinds itself back into the nominal position. Those are all, again, details that can be implemented. Again, I want to stress the warp system is very fluid in how it can be implemented. There are numerous ways it can be done. Some are probably less economic than others. And that's where the smarts of whoever takes this and implements it and would like some advice from perhaps what we've learned could be of benefit. And that's why we provide engineering consulting as well for clients.
Now, in your name, you have the name ENECO along with WARP. And WARP stands for Wind Amplified Rotor Platform. What does ENECO stand for?
Well, ENECO came about really because of the concepts of energy, economy, and ecology. So we're talking environment, economics, and energy, if I repeated those correctly. I can't remember now. Those three factors, energy, ecology, and economy.
Okay. You are aware that there's another company by the name of Eneco in Salt Lake City who is developing a solid-state thermoelectric technology that's actually a spin-off of the cold fusion work that was done at the University of Utah.
Well, I have heard of that lately, but I was actually more aware of the one in the Netherlands that's a huge utility there called Eneco as well. But our name, the LLC is officially the Eneco Texas.
Eneco Texas LLC?
LLC, correct.
Mm-hmm. So in the process of rolling this technology out, you've had a number of people coming to you with interest, but the problem has been getting the financing. Is it because the people with the money are afraid to get involved in disruptive technology?
That I don't really I cannot say, to be honest with you, because we don't know in all cases what is driving in most cases they were actually looking to situations like a subsidy from the government. For example, an Austrian firm, Amst, was in licensing arrangements with us already, expecting the Austrian government to legislate wind power subsidies. When they didn't, which was a big surprise to them, the whole deal fell apart. Similarly, when Raytheon company, this is the folks that made the Patriot missile, selected the technology for proposal to the NREL, they naturally wanted Uncle Sam's money since they're an aerospace company, and coming out of the aerospace field, I'm very much aware that the aerospace companies don't do anything except with Uncle Sam's money, primarily. So when they ran into a political wall there because, frankly, NREL has nurtured the big bladed systems, and this was going to be very disruptive to their whole operation, and in essence jeopardizes their $30-40 million a year budget that Congress would have, and they said, well, if this goes and looks good, Congress is going to cut us, out and throw us just a bone, and that's the end of our situation here. And that was one of the reasons I believe they didn't let Raytheon in. I mean, Raytheon is no slouch. They did poured over the technology for months at their Lexington R&D Center with half a dozen PhDs, and they knew the answer before they put a proposal on the street. So that's a given, and they're well represented in the literature with it. So there's no point to have to debate them on that. But it was purely, I think, an issue where they couldn't get the funding, and then mm-hmm. we couldn't continue to work on that basis without having funding, obviously.
Just about done with our time. We've got a couple minutes to wrap it up here, but we've not talked yet about the underwater application, and obviously if you've got moving wind, you can turn those turbines. Another application would be moving water, whether it's a river or a tide or ocean currents, for example. How would you transmit the electricity if you're using brushes? Wouldn't you be shorting yourself out underwater? How would you get around that?
Well, in water, it would be slightly different underwater, because there you definitely hardwire it, and just like any other underwater turbine does. It's but clearly you make a good point. The warp system is a fluid technology, really. It doesn't matter whether it's wind or water that's being amplified. The same thing holds true. In fact, you can have that operate quite nicely in deep water. That's what makes the warps for offshore use particularly attractive, since now you can go beyond the range where you have shallow water, which is what the big turbine blades need to be embedded in the seabed. Here you can have actually buoyancy floating like giant buoys operating and being then interconnected to the land, just like they have platforms with oil and gas platforms, and they interconnect with shore at times. So that's very doable, and ironically, the oil and gas industry would probably benefit the most from offshore warp systems, because they certainly have the expertise in deploying platforms in deep water.
Well, Alan Gunther, we appreciate you coming on the show. Again, your website is warp-enico.com. Is that correct?
That's correct. Thank you.
We also have coverage of you over at pezwiki.com, and you did squeak into the top 100 energy technology, so you're now listed there as well.
Thanks very much.
Right.
We wish you the best as you roll this thing forward.
Thank you, Sterling. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and should you ever want to discuss this further, there's certainly a lot to cover in this kind of technology, but we certainly appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, and I hope your audience learned something about it.
You're certainly welcome.
Thanks again, Sterling. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.